you're conscious and curious about climate solutions, I think it's a really great one to make the decision when it's time to switch to electric or induction.
This is Climate Curious, the podcast for people who are bored, scared, or confused by climate change.
I'm Marion Pasha, the director and curator at TEDx London and the co-host of this podcast, alongside the amazing Ben.
Hi, I'm Ben Hurst, activist and advocate exploring what positive masculinities can look like and self-confessed climate normie.
It's a wild ride, gas stoves. After 50 years of relative, obscurity of the health impacts, gas stoves are having their moment in the limelight, for better or worse. So we released a report in December, and there has been a flurry of media and attention here in the U.S. and overseas, and a lot of people saying, wait a minute, my gas stove may be harming my health. What's the science?
Who are you?
Well, my name is Brady Seals. I work at RMI. We're a nonprofit organization, and I've worked on cook stoves my whole career, so going on 14 years. I started out working in Africa, the Caribbean, where around 4 billion people are still cooking with wood and charcoal. And we were working to promote cleaner alternative fuels, such as gas. And I would come home from these trips and cook my own food on gas. And then about 3 years ago, I started at RMI in our buildings program. And so we are out there trying to help electrify our buildings, make them efficient. But one thing kept happening when we talked about the climate impacts of burning fossil fuels in buildings. People kept saying, the stove has this outsized health impact. And I started talking to air quality experts, health experts, and they said, nothing has changed, but we've been studying this for 50 years. And there's really real studies. There's over 50 studies around the world. Some of the very early studies were in the UK in the 70s, but there's been hardly any policy and gas stoves are unvented. So we dug into the research, we talked to tons of experts, and we started compiling it. So in some ways, I may have started my career on wood and charcoal stoves and moving to cleaner alternatives. And this hopefully is the next chapter of helping move to the cleanest of stoves for our health and for climate, which are electric and induction stoves.
So can I ask a question? Well, obviously I can ask a question. I'm going to ask a question, which is, in the hierarchy of clean energy, where does gas fall? Because you said, it to me, it sounds like it's in the middle with coal at the bottom and electric at the top. Is there other stuff or is that the whole picture?
That's a lot of the picture. So exactly at the bottom, we have the traditional fuels, wood, charcoal, dung. These things produce a lot of particulate matter.
Dung,
yes. Yeah, little hard cakes of dung. Right. Yes, exactly. maybe how all of our ancestors would cook at some point, but in some places, that is still a fuel source. So I spent my early career in some of the Somali refugee camps in Ethiopia, where it was so desperate, there was hardly any wood fuel. It was getting really deforested. So at the time, I was helping to promote a bioethanol, so an ethanol-based cook stove, where, for example, in Ethiopia and places where they have a lot of sugar production, the waste product, the molasses, could be turned into ethanol. So you have the solid fuels, and then you have pellets. So these are a bit more efficient, like taking the waste from the sugar cane and turning it into pellets. Like that. And then you have your liquid fuels. So that's the gas. You also have bioethanol and also biogas, which people use. But then really coming to the top where we see, because there's no combustion pollutants, is electric cook stoves. And here in the US, about over a third of households still cook with gas. And so although in the US electricity is the dominant fuel source, there's still a significant number of people cooking with gas. And even I thought 3 years ago that gas was the cleaner fuel. It was one of the, it was a lot better than wood. But what we've learned, or what I've learned, is that there has been a whole body of research for 50 years that have said gas has all these other nasty pollutants that we're burning and living with in our homes. Right. And in fact, the last couple of months, we're actually learning even more about that gas.
And you, so you've worked with all of the materials across all of the sectors, or I don't know if sectors is the right word, but you've worked across the board, right? And it should, does, am I wrong in assuming that every household in America has access to electricity? Like, there's electricity running through the majority of the houses, right?
That's right. Here so in then, the US, yes.
Mm-hmm. So why are people still using gas stoves? What has gone wrong here? Why are we stuck? Or what did you find with the research?
Well, we found in the research that there are very well documented risks of gas stoves. And in fact, a summary study which looks at all the research says, you know, our strongest evidence is on children and children's health. And it finds that children who live in a home with a gas stove have a 42% increased risk of having asthma symptoms and about a 24% risk of being diagnosed with asthma by a doctor. So these are big numbers. And in our most recent study, we found that that risk is almost comparable with living with a smoker, with children's asthma risk of secondhand smoke. But nobody knew about this. I didn't know about this. I've worked on stoves for so long. I do think that there's been a well-funded marketing campaign. Now you're cooking with gas and the blue flame. And so I think that that has helped people think that gas is a superior product. So induction stoves, most people haven't heard of them. I hadn't cooked on an induction stove until 3 years ago. Less than 3% market share. And so I think the other piece was there wasn't this modern, amazing technology that you could say, this is so much better than gas.
And I remember the Mario, I don't know if you remember this, but do you remember the British Gas logo used to be like a blue flame? Did it used to be a little blue fireman?
It used to be a little blue dancing flame, and it was all like natural gas, and it was so. I remember.
I used to really like first, that.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, like, I remember the first few weeks into this podcast and really starting to think about fossil fuels, and I mean, put my hand up and say that I didn't even at that point realize that gas was a fossil fuel. I mean, in hindsight, of course it is, right? But it's what you're talking about here with that marketing campaign, it was so well done.
Yeah.
It's so decoupled in our minds, the risk of burning something
you're like, this fine,
you know, in small confined spaces, and you know, our health. And those numbers that you talk about with childhood asthma, that's quite that's huge. And I'm curious to know, when this research came out, you know, as you said, there's been 50 years of research, which I'm also shocked to hear. Like, I had no idea there was such a kind of rich, long history of it. But I'm just curious to know, with this new piece that's come out, what's been the response in where you are in the US?
Exactly. So we knew there was this 50 years of evidence. We had this 42% increased risk. And so we knew it was bad. And the question that we had was, how bad is it? And how can we try to quantify that? And so we partnered with two epidemiologists from Albert Einstein College of Medicine here in New York, and also from University of Sydney in Australia. And what we did was...
What's an epidemiologist?
Oh, an epidemiologist is a public health expert. So these are, public health, often professors.
Right. It's the kind of word that people say, and I feel like I'm supposed to know, but I have no idea.
It's a great question. So we worked with these two public health experts, these epidemiologists, and we did a very basic calculation. It's essentially a math calculation. And so we knew this 42% increased risk figure. That was from 41 studies. And so we said, okay, let's just pull out the US studies, the Canada studies, and the European and UK, because those housing characteristics are probably similar. So with that, we actually got even a little bit of a decreased risk, 34%. So 34% risk from that geography. Then we had to figure out how many households in the U.S. with children cook with gas. And the interesting thing we found was we know about, at the time, the best data we had, 35% of households cook with gas. But the proportion of households with children that cook with gas is higher. So nationally in the U.S., it's 43%. But in some states, like Illinois, it's 80%. California is in the 70s, New York. So you have some states where almost 75% of households with children cook with gas. So what we did then was very basic. We just calculated this 34% increased risk for this amount of households. And so what we found is that nationally, about 12.7% is our best estimate of childhood asthma could be linked to gas stoves. So 12.7%, what does that mean? And that's where we looked at what else is around this 12-13% risk for childhood asthma. And that's where we found exposure to secondhand smoke. So when you look at the risk profile of gas stoves for children and asthma, where we have the most evidence in the peer-reviewed literature, it's very similar. But because of the high proportion of households in certain states that cook with gas, that number was much higher. So almost 20% in Illinois or 18.8% in New York. And so it's very regional. So that study, we put it out there. It's a calculation. It was peer-reviewed. We got a couple little news articles about it explaining the science. But then what really happened is gas stoves aren't regulated in the U.S. It's technically a consumer product, but there's hardly any rules. So gas stoves have almost like a free rein to pollute. They don't have to meet any standards, which is wild. Think about all the things in our households, baby products, etc., that have to meet a safety standard.
Even plugs and stuff.
Even plugs, exactly. And these are basically having high levels of emissions, combustion emissions, which are reach levels that if they were outdoors would be illegal, with no limits on them. So here we have the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Their job is to regulate products and make sure they're safe for us as consumers. And so when you trace it back, one of the Consumer Product Safety Commissioners had said, look, if a product can't be made safe, it can be banned. And it was this B word, the B word, the ban word, that really started the floodgates of the media. I was doing 50 interviews a week. We had, you mentioned before, 25,000 media hits. And interestingly, it was across every major publication, the right, the left, the middle, academics. And I think a lot of people were realizing that gas stoves aren't as safe as we thought. But then there was, unfortunately, this culture war here, as it's called in the U.S., where other people were afraid that somebody was going to come into your home and take your gas stove. And on Twitter, people were taping themselves to their stoves and turning on all their burners, which, of course, was never going to happen. Even any performance standard would have to relate to new stoves. And so for better or worse, it became a cultural moment, went a little viral, but it got people talking. And we're seeing now the polling that it's made a huge impact. 60% of parents would consider switching from their gas stove to an electric stove because of health impacts.
Wow. That is quite incredible. Like, that's quite an incredible journey to go on. I want to unpick a couple of things about it, actually. So just zooming in specifically, that must feel quite good to know that you've gotten through people. Like, despite this kind of, I remember reading those headlines, like, you can take my gas stove from my cold dead hands kind of, you know, rhetoric. Despite that polarization, which I want to come back to in a second, do you feel like you've gotten through? Do you feel like now this is something that is much more on people's radar? And are you getting different kinds of questions? Is the work, I'm just curious to know if you're already starting to see a different attitude around this.
Absolutely. I think it was a huge success. I don't know your media if you think any news is good news, but I think overwhelmingly people see the science and are you know, it makes sense when you start looking at your stove and side-eyeing your stove and realizing, yeah, this thing is unvented, maybe, and burning an open flame with emissions that we know is bad, and it makes sense. And so I think there is part of that. I also think, and, you know, working in climate and you guys with this podcast, health is something that maybe hits people before climate. If it's bad for climate, yeah, it's probably bad for your health, but what are you going to feel first? And if you're worried about your kids' health or your own health or your parents' health in a retirement home. And so I think for a lot of people, this can make it feel very personal, which can be uncomfortable. A lot of people said, a lot of my family members and friends said, well, I love my gas stove. It's so fast and it's so great. So it becomes personal, but I think that there's a benefit to that that gets us really thinking about it and talking about it. And we, as a climate organization, sometimes talk to the same people. Who's reading our reports? Probably similar audiences. But with this, we reached corners that we don't often reach. And so when I think about it, and I don't know if you've heard of the sort of six audiences of climate people, and there's the people alarmed about climate and everything. And then the people who are dismissive are very small. It's a very small percentage of people who can't be moved. And I think that health is one of these things, especially something in your home, in your kitchen. It can get personal and it can be uncomfortable. But to me, I think, and I've heard from others, that induction stove pre-sales are just skyrocketing and people are ready to make the switch. And thank goodness we have a product like induction, which is actually so much better and easy to clean and fast to cook on, that you don't have to go back to an electric coil stove.
I have to say, I love my induction cooker. Like, I would never, if it wasn't, like, even if it wasn't for the health and the climate, I would never go back to that. Like, why would you have something that, like, literally, like, it's just, there's like a million reasons why I wouldn't go back to it. And I think you're right. Like, it is, once you start, you go down that route. I think it's the same with electric cars, actually. I have to say this. Like, people are all like, whatever. And then the first time you sit in an electric car, you're like,
oh, God, this is so much good. Better.
I think that there's a real, like, one of the reasons we were so excited to have you on the show as well is, you know, we have listeners from all around the world, but also the UK. And actually, I feel like this conversation hasn't taken off in the UK in the same way. And it really should. And I think there's a real concern for people, because so many people, especially younger people, like people Ben's age, my age, you know, we rent, you know, we don't own. So we have so little control over the appliances in our home. And I think that there's really, like, this is basically an appeal to anyone listening who works in policy in this country, where we need to start regulating we need to start regulating gas stoves out of rental properties, because, you know, and so this made me think, Brady, is there, in the research that you did and the kind of breaking down of all these demographics, were you finding that certain demographics were also, like, you talked about various states, were there other things, other demographics that you looked at where they were more at risk of being exposed to kind of these levels of toxic gas in their homes?
Absolutely. So one thing that's very clear from the research is the smaller the home, the smaller the unit size, the higher the concentration. And I'm so glad brought up renters, because, you know, we've all been in some places. My sister-in-law has been in the UK for a while, and I remember being her in her little flat with her two kids in London. And so I think for you as well as for us, and I'm from New York originally, we have a lot of renters and small apartments with unvented gas stoves. And so size of your dwelling is a huge one. We also know that there's an environmental justice concern from this, because one of the things that's also very clear from the research is, if you already have asthma, gas stove pollution can exacerbate that, especially for children. And asthma is one of the most unequal diseases, with Black and brown children having much higher rates of asthma. And if you live in a place in a polluted, you know, your outdoor air isn't fresh. And I know this is a big problem in London from diesel and some of the other things. So what do we need to do? Ventilate. Well, if you're opening your air and your indoor air is polluted and your outdoor air is polluted, it can be a big problem. And here in the U.S., because of sort of legacy redlining and poor policies, it's very unequal, the air that we breathe. And so I would say the two things that stand out to me when I see the literature is really already having an unequal health burden to begin with, which is very compounded by living in maybe polluted neighborhoods, and then having a smaller unit size and also having more people in that unit size can lead to higher concentrations of pollutants, which can affect exposure.
Feels like, just like so many other issues, Ben, that we've talked about in this podcast, is it just intersects with so many other things that are happening and putting certain communities and certain kinds of kind of people under more risk and more pressure.
Yeah. And it's interesting, right? You were saying earlier about this idea of, well, you weren't saying, my brain was talking about, like, conspiracy Ben was activated, and the idea of, like, the PR campaign that has surrounded this. Because if, like, I've got questions around how long did we know all of this information for, and, like, why was nothing done about it? And I think one of the good things about this podcast is that we don't spend a lot of time pointing fingers and assigning blame to people, which I think is actually important to move the conversation forward. But I am interested in, like, how we start to, if we're talking about, because it sounds like it's all about power, but it sounds like it's all about power, and the more power you have over individual decision making, like, you can change situations for yourself. I'm interested, Mariam, you already mentioned the idea of, like, policy and lobbying for renters to have appliances in the household changed. I'm wondering if you've got any other examples of, like, how we can change the situation, because this is literally as bad as smoking in the house, right, in terms of, like, poisoning children and air pollution and all of those kinds of ideas. So how do we start to change that in, like, the public consciousness, but also allow people to have access to making better decisions for themselves?
I'm so glad you brought that up, and you're right, we can't always point a finger. And let's be honest, gas kept the lights on for us for a long time, and it's a lot better than coal, and that's where we went. But let's talk about coal for a second. So coal was the dominant heating fuel in the U.S. for so long. And could you imagine just sort of the drudgery associated with getting your coal? And it just, it was terrible. And so when gas came, it made people's lives so much better, and it was better for the climate. And we got off, as the U.S., we got completely off of coal within 40 years. This was way back when. So we had the technology of gas, and we were able to roll it out. So I think we can do that now. I think that we're at the moment where, with gas, where we were with coal, and the positives are, it might be a lot easier to electrify our buildings and make them more efficient than address some of the other really challenging climate problems, like, what are we going to do about the cement industry and steel, where we're still working on solutions. And so to me, buildings seem like such an amazing opportunity for policy to address, because we have induction stoves, we have heat pumps, we know what to do. All these homes, like you say, already have electricity. We're not reinventing the wheel. So we got off coal in 40 years in the U.S. How long is it going to take to do that with gas? I think, you know, given the reports that are coming out this week, we need to do it soon. But to me, it seems like, can you think of a climate solution that is more about people and health than our buildings, where we spend 90% of our time? It has to be a mix of policy and incentives. Here in the U.S., we have the biggest climate bill that I will probably ever see in my lifetime. You can get up to $840 to get an induction stove or electric stove. So that's great if I can do that.
How?
with rebates. It's with rebates.
Is that available to me? Because I could use $840.
It's part of the Inflation Reduction Act. And there is so much in there for heat pumps and and everything, which is amazing, but it has to go with policy. Because what about our public housing? What about our renters? And we know that these are the exact populations who should be getting the benefits first. And so I think you're right. It's got to be policy. It can be incentives as well. We did it in coal in 40 years. We have the solutions for electricity, political will and funding, and I think we can get there.
I'm so hopeful about, I have to say, like, you know, based in the UK, obviously I work a lot in the US. I think, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act was such a hopeful moment. You know, I know it's the beginning, but it does make me really hope that it inspires like Europe and the UK to start passing similar kinds of really kind of once, as you said, like once in a lifetime legislation that could just transform the economy. Because I feel like that's what's needed at this point. And I think we look over with some, as I look over at the US with envious eyes at this point, hoping that that somehow we start to think about something. And I think Europe is starting to think about something similar. I wanted to ask two questions just to round this out. One of them is, we've been talking a lot about the climate impacts of gas and the climate impacts of buildings. And I'm just wondering, for people who maybe aren't as familiar with it, maybe could you just take us through a little bit of some of the top line things we need to understand when we're thinking about gas and climate and buildings and climate?
Absolutely. So buildings are actually our global biggest polluters. 40% of global emissions comes from buildings. And so from a climate perspective, there's a big need to address the fossil fuels and the materials we use to build our buildings. But let's talk about the home. So in our homes, we have a couple of appliances, maybe four or five, that might burn fossil fuels. Your furnace, your water heater, your stove, and maybe your clothes dryer. So if you have these appliances in your home and they burn gas, most of them have to be vented outdoors because of building codes and laws. So our furnaces and water heaters vent pollution outdoors. And this pollution is bad for climate and bad for health because it produces things like nitrogen dioxide and particulate matter, which turns into smog and ozone and other pieces. So outdoors, it's really about neighborhood level air quality and some of these greenhouse gas emissions that are bad for climate, but also the other air pollutions, which we see like smog and ozone. The gas stove has this outsized health impact because it's the one appliance that often is unvented in our homes where we spend 90% of our times that we're standing in front of. And so gas stoves don't have as big of a climate impact outdoors because they're vented inside. They don't use as much energy. But taken together, these couple of appliances added up with all the other homes and businesses burning them lead up to this 40% global emissions. And so it's a key area to target. And also just to add that new research is showing how much methane, which is a very potent greenhouse gas, how much methane is actually leaking from the natural gas supply chain. Unfortunately, gas, when it's in pipes, it just wants to get out and leak, and it ends up leaking in our homes, and it ends up leaking in our under our streets. In the US, we have 3 million miles of pipelines. So there's this macro issue with the pipelines and how much methane, which natural gas is almost all methane, and new studies on gas stoves are showing that benzene and other air toxins are also present in gas and could potentially be leaking alongside the methane. So the more we learn, I think the worse the picture is getting from a climate and health perspective.
Yeah, this really just isn't good for us at all, is it? I feel like this is over. It's the same as last time. It's just overwhelmingly bad. When faced with like the reality of the situation, there really is no reason to continue to use this method of cooking.
This actually brings me to my last question for you, Brady, which is, I'm going to make an assumption, listeners, that you are all now convinced.
Yeah.
If you weren't before. What are some alternatives? We talked about induction. Are there other things that people could switch to? Like, what are some things that come to mind?
Well, first of all, if you're listening to this and feeling terrified, I want you to know that there are some things that you can do right now, today. The first is, if you do have a gas stove, you can open a window. You can, if you have a range hood, turn on your range hood and actually cook on the back burners where range hoods are more effective. The next step is to try to displace some of your cooking. I'm sure a lot of people in the UK, everyone has an electric kettle, I bet. Electric kettles, air fryers, toaster ovens, instant pots. So if you have these appliances already, you can try to limit the amount of time you have to turn on your gas stove. That's the second step. The third step, you can get a plug-in induction, either a one plate or a two plate. And so I've seen really creative ways where people actually turn their gas stove into an induction stove. If you're a renter or if you can't afford or can't commit to getting an induction stove right away, where as long as your gas stove doesn't have pilot lights, you can put a butcher block or two sheet pans on top of it, and then you can plug in your induction stoves nearby, put them on top, save yourself counter space, and see if you like the induction experience. That would be the third stage. And then the fourth stage, I think, is trying to transition to an electric or an induction range. So I don't think that people need to run out right away and change it out if they want to. That's also great. But when it's time, I think the key thing is to make that decision as an individual or as a family that I won't switch like for like. I won't change out the gas stove to just get another gas stove, because truly, one of the biggest things that we can do for the climate that makes the highest impact is the way we heat and cook our homes and also how we drive. And so if you're conscious and curious about climate solutions, I think it's a really great one to make the decision when it's time to switch to electric or induction.
An important messaging, right? That it's not like, do it now, do it today, but like when it's possible, feel empowered that you have the ability to make a better decision. And also a better decision for your own health, right? Even if, especially if you're somebody who's, I don't know why you'd be listening this far in, but if you are somebody who's listening to this podcast and you're like, nah, still don't care. Well, think about yourself, think about your own well-being. And then maybe it's just a better decision for you on a personal level. I don't know.
And now, it's time for our climate confessions. Let's fess up to the bad habits we just can't kick.
Now, the reason we do this is not to shame people. There is no climate shame here. It's actually the opposite. It's easy when you're first learning about and being part of the climate movement and trying to understand things to feel like you can only really care if everything you do is perfect. But actually, as Ben and I have come to realize, there is no such thing as perfect, and everyone is on a journey. And this is just about bringing a bit of light to that darkness. I'm happy to go first, so that we break the ice. Mine is a constant confession, but one that was really highlighted to me yesterday. So I was doing a bit of an inventory of the last year, and just to see kind of, I was taking stock, and I counted the number of trips I had taken last year. And I was really shocked. I've got a lot of offsetting to do and replanning of my travel this year to do, because it's all flying. So I took more than one flight a month.
Better start planting some trees, mate. Some shrubs. I'm sure somebody's told us that that's not how it works.
Yeah. It's all right. We'll do something. Brady, over to you.
Okay. On the hot seat. I have to admit that since I found out I was doing this podcast, I have been to not one but two climate happy hours, and I have asked this question to other climate people, and I think people love to confess. It feels good to get it off their chest. It's a great question. For me, I'm going to stay in the kitchen for this one and admit that I am a very lazy and often not a great composter, which I feel terrible about, but I know that composting and project drawdown and others say it's one of the best things that we can do for the climate. And sometimes I just really get lazy and months will go without me putting something in my compost bin.
Now, okay, hold on. We have to explain this to us. Why? Just explain to us a bit more about composting, because I actually am intrigued by this.
Yeah, I'm like, that's mine as well. Oh, I've never composted a day in my life.
Tell us more about it. Like, what? Why should we be doing it? Why does Project Drawdown say that it's so effective? Yeah, just tell us a bit more about it.
Okay, so food waste is such a huge contributor to climate problems. And so if we can collect all of our food waste together, it can actually make such a huge impact. And I think I'm feeling shameful about this because I live in Boulder, Colorado, which makes it really easy, the city compost. So maybe where you are, if you don't have a backyard, it's really hard to get something. But essentially, by taking all of our food scraps, we can turn it into food for worms and things like that. So we're regenerating and it's not ending up in landfills. Even here in Boulder, if you go to a coffee shop, your coffee cup is probably coming in a compostable mug. And even in the city, they'll have recycling, garbage, and compost. And so I am ashamed about this because I live in one of probably the places in the world that makes it as easy as possible for me to collect all of my food scraps in a pail, take it to a specific compost bin, and somebody will come and the city will compost it. So in Boulder, where I live, maybe this feels especially shameful. But there's a really interesting, if you're compost curious, there are some fascinating.
That's the new podcast.
There are some fascinating options where you can actually get a device that'll compost itself, and it's all self-contained, or you can create boxes. So it's really trying to reduce food waste and prevent it from ending up in landfills.
I'm so intrigued by composting. I'm like on the border, because I also have been learning more about food waste and methane and all this kind of stuff, and I feel like, yeah, I feel like maybe I could have one more burger if I compost.
Yeah, it's like the other half of recycling, right? It's like you recycle the
cardboard. Well, this is what I was gonna say, is that I feel like it's better than recycling. This is what I'm coming to think about, because I feel like recycling has gotten so confusing, if that makes sense. Like, are they actually recycling it? Are they not? Where are they taking it to? Who's doing it? Is it being shipped? All of that kind of stuff has just become, it's become so opaque, and so, like, so many systems where you can't see what's happening. It feels like maybe there are some issues here, but it feels like if you can compost, it's like food, it goes into a thing, it becomes a thing, you can use it. You're just seeing the whole life cycle. I love this. We're going to do a whole episode, I think, on composting.
Three
now.
Or four.
And we're going to call it. And we're going to call it
composting. Yeah.
I love it. Ben, sneak yours in.
Oh, I thought I was going to get away with it. One of them is that I've not been composting, but I yeah, that is evidently something to think about. I feel like I've regressed, man. I feel like the cost of living crisis got me, and I fell into the idea of like using the fireplace and burning a lot of wood, which we did all through the winter because it was cheaper than switching on the heating. And now I feel really, really guilty about it, which is not the purpose of this. But yeah, I think that's
a reality.
So many people. And that's something that I've got to consider in terms of like where the balance is. Do you know what I mean? In terms of like the financial aspect and the actual like survival of the planet aspect, and kind of meeting those somewhere and finding some better solutions. So that's something I'm going to be thinking about, I think. Well, not for now, because we're moving into the spring and the summer, but in a couple of months, we'll swing back round to
when you're cold again.
Yeah, when it gets desperate. Oh, my gosh.
Well, thank you so much. This has been an incredible conversation and just so interesting for you to share the research with us and the work you've been doing and kind of how you've been getting the word out there. And, yeah, just incredible to see real impact, I feel, and real movement, which is awesome. Mm.
It's amazing. We should do this again in 5 years and see what the market share of induction is. But I love talking to you both. This has been great. I really enjoyed my time.
You are on. Thanks, Brady. And Ben, remember,
stay curious.
Thank you for joining us this week. We really hope you enjoyed this episode.
If you did, please hit the follow button to make sure you get next week's release.
We are now officially crowdsourcing Climate Confessions, so please leave yours in the ratings and the reviews section, and we'll shout out for you next time. And shout out to our fabulous team behind the pod.
This episode was produced by Josie Coulter.
Comms written by Tess Lowry.
Artwork designed by Rebecca Mingus.
Curation by Mariam Pasha.
Mixed and engineered by Ben Beheshti.
Music also by Ben Beheshti.
Presented by Ben Hurst
and Mariam Pasha. Remember, stay curious.